So we're going to move on to talk about the parami, the perfection of patience. Before we do that, is there anything outstanding? I don't know if you remember, yesterday I mentioned the ways in which this quality of virya is tempered by patience, because clearly the very shadow side of that kind of heroism is striving, over-efforting, overdoing, and can get very caught up with goals and then success and failure and becoming disheartened and discouraged when our path or our practice doesn't quite deliver what we thought it was going to. So patience is meant to be such an important aspect of the quality of compassion of the whole of this path in the cultivation of awakening. And there's many different ways that patience is spoken about. Now, its shadow side, of course, is endurance. You know, simply gritting one's teeth in a rather over-earnest way. This is not patience. Bearing in mind how much all of these paramis are related to or rooted in investigation and in insight, they are actual understandings, so developments of understanding. Sometimes patience is spoken about the patience that can arise when we feel wronged, when we feel misinterpreted, when we feel harmed or dismissed by another. The patience to bear adversity, to stay steady with adversity and hardship and difficulty, and the patience to face the truth without fear. The Dalai Lama speaks of patience as a deep capacity and willingness to remain steadfast in the face of adversity. Sometimes it's translated, often translated as forbearance or tolerance. Now, we all have adversity. This is probably part of our, no doubt, part of our universal story. There's, I doubt, anybody in this room who will be eternally free of adversity and affliction. And it is in the midst of adversity that we are prone to some of our most core habitual patterns of frustration, of blame, of being judgmental, of being defensive, of being aggressive. How many of us find ourselves being impatient with people who disappoint us? Impatient with events that displease us. Impatient even with all the things that we label as being rather boring and rather unsatisfying. We are so prone, actually, you know, and it's very important to see the way that impatience is part of the fabric of aversion. It's not separate from aversion. We become impatient with people in situations that don't change as quickly as we would like them to. You ever found that? I've really pointed out to you the ways that you need to change. You know? Why isn't it happening? We become impatient with ourselves. I think we become very impatient with our own minds, their seemingly bottomless capacity to tell the same story. To when we find ourselves governed by the same reactions. Ever seen that word again? One of the greatest saboteurs of patience and mindfulness. I'm doing it again. You're doing it again. We become so impatient at times with our bodies, with pain, with our minds. And those are the times when there's a kind of unwise abandonment of just wanting something to be over. Impatience is not only a kind of aversion, sometimes it's also a kind of fear. Like, what if this always is forever? What if this won't change? What if I won't change? And when we see when there's impatience, how aversion stimulates craving. Because we see when we're impatient with something, we want it to be over, we find it unsatisfying. What do we do with that aversion? It stimulates craving to lean forward into the better moment, to lean forward into the next moment, the more ideal moment. You know, when this is over, then I will be really patient, you know, or then I will be really happy, or then I will be really content. So it is very important to see how impatience is born of aversion, and it stimulates not only craving, but it stimulates agitation. How do we make this go away? How do we fix this? How do we impose these changes? How do we manipulate these conditions? So impatience really activates the very deep tendencies of greed and ill will. It is why this parami of patience is such an insight practice of what do we cultivate in those moments of dissatisfaction, of discontent, of frustration, of disappointment. Do we cultivate stillness or do we feed agitation? Do we cultivate contentment, our capacity to be with what is, or do we cultivate craving? I really love that Zen cartoon where a young student is clearly asking an elder a question and he's looking at him with some sense of puzzlement and he says, "Nothing comes next. This is it." Now that's interesting because that's not a statement of passivity. It's not a statement, you know, that this will always be forever. It's not a statement of despair. But it is really asking us, how do we meet this moment if nothing, if we could imagine that nothing comes next? What qualities of heart and mind would be cultivated if nothing comes next? So this patience is really, in my understanding, it's an invitation to find peace within ourselves. Sometimes it's an invitation to find steadfastness rather than fixing. Sometimes it's an invitation to find calmness rather than excitement and intensity. Because we see often impatience does arise in moments, particularly in more neutral moments in our life that we label as being boring or unsatisfying in some ways. We see that leaning to find something exciting that's going to make us feel alive. And, you know, what I see is that this is one of the greatest addictions in Western culture, is to feel so deprived of aliveness, inwardly generated aliveness, inwardly generated happiness and well-being, that is so much part of the way that craving manifests in Western culture, is how do I find something stimulating that is going to make me feel awake, make me feel alive, that is going to be a satisfactory substitute for what I feel to be missing within myself. Patience is not endurance. It's certainly not a submission to suffering. And here there's a very big difference between bowing to something and bowing down to something. And that is such an important distinction in our lives. Passivity, I would say, is the near enemy of patience. You know, nothing I can do, the sense of despair, you know, nothing that I can bring to this moment, you know, I just need to sort of grit my teeth and endure it. Patience, I think, has some very different quality. It is a deep commitment not to abandon anything. Very deep commitment not to abandon anything. Not anything in the world, not anything in ourselves or in others. And where do we cultivate patience? I'm sure the answer is fairly obvious to all of us. As a cultivation, we cultivate patience in the midst of impatience. And I doubt that any of us are short of opportunities to do this. From the moment that we get up in the morning to when we go to bed at night, when life doesn't move fast enough for us, or doesn't deliver what we want, or doesn't, you know, accord to our expectations, we practice patience in the midst of impatience. It's speaking of a deep quality of steadfastness as a path. You know, this is again a path, it's a cultivation. Impatience, as I mentioned, is a reaction to the unsatisfactory, which turns into aversion. Now, insight recognizes simply that there is unsatisfactoriness. Just that there is unsatisfactoriness. There is a time when action is needed, response is needed in relationship to the unsatisfactory, and there are times when we need to learn to sit with the discomfort, to live with the discomfort of not getting what we want, of the world not being how we wish it to be. These two coexist, knowing when there's time for action, knowing when it is a time to be still with discomfort. Now, and I know any of you who've been around Rodney long enough, this is one of his theme tunes. That in our culture we do have a very low tolerance for discomfort. We think it shouldn't be happening. It was an amazing thought to have. In a world which is unsatisfactory, change, unstable conditions, that we should have the thought that this shouldn't be happening. But what we do... It's quite a funny thought, actually. But we, in that low tolerance for discomfort, and somehow this core level of rejection of discomfort, we can devote so much attention, time, and energy to not being uncomfortable, to not being disturbed. And, you know, sometimes it's kind of embarrassing to sort of reflect on our day and just think how much time and energy we can devote to not being uncomfortable. It comes in the subtlest ways, doesn't it? You know, the most subtle ways, you know, a little hint of I might be a bit cold and I'm unpacking all of my winter garments, you know. A slightest itch in my ear and I'm, you know, all over, cast into agitation, you know. The threat of lunch not being on time and I'm sort of making plans about where is the nearest restaurant. We have so much agitation in our lives. Not being around people who make us uncomfortable. Not being in situations that... It's not about even about being uncomfortable. It's the threat of discomfort. You know, it's even the hint, the possibility of being uncomfortable. So what is... You know, we don't want to be disturbed often. That's kind of seems to be part of our kind of psychological makeup of aversion. It's not wanting to be disturbed. So what is really the discomfort? It's actually the discomfort of me. It's the discomfort of me. the sense of me, the sense of I that feels in the face of the unpleasant sensation, I am going to be annihilated, I'm going to be overwhelmed, I'm going to have the rug pulled out from underneath me, I'm not going to survive, that somehow me being disturbed or uncomfortable is going to lead to the dissolution of the me that I so rely on staying the same. The discomfort of me, the discomfort of not getting what I need. Now, Baker Roshi, and again, we need to be careful with this statement because as we did acknowledge very clearly yesterday, there are millions, millions of people in this world who do not have enough on very real levels. So what we are talking about here is very much the psychological, emotional state of insufficiency, not the reality that governs countless people in this world that does ask for wise response. But Baker Roshi once said that the definition of a Buddha is that they always have what they need. It is the paradox of the Bodhisattva vow that suffering is endless, but I vow to end it. When patience disappears, we probably notice that compassion disappears with it, that kindness disappears when patience disappears, because what happens when impatience arises, that quality of aversion, we see this in ourselves, the turning away from, the resistance, the not listening, the closing down, the disconnection, the making of distance, that the very ground of compassion disappears with impatience and aversion. So the source, I would suggest, of impatience is not in the events of the world, that the source of impatience is really in our own minds of hearts. It's a mind of refusal. It's a mind of refusal that does very, very little but mar our capacity to be with what is where we are. So in the fabric of impatience, and this is where we are cultivating patience, remember, in the fabric of impatience we see the power of craving, aversion, restlessness, not what we want, the agitation to bring what we don't want to an end. Many layers of this. I've seen it even, you know, it's one of those kind of, we could make a cartoon, you know, on retreats when we're leaving the meditation hall and you're behind the slowest walking meditator in the world and you're looking for the opportunity to overtake so you can begin your walking meditation. We're kind of doing that in our lives, trying to overtake so we can get to where we want to be so we can begin to be patient and mindful. If I just overtake this person or this event or this situation, you know, I'll get to where I want to be so I can begin to be mindful and patient. So I want to look at some of these levels of patience that I mentioned. The patience when wronged. I mean, in this world of human relationship, there are many times when we feel wronged by another. When we somehow feel insulted or slandered or betrayed or misused or taken advantage of, or our intent, one of the most difficult ones, when our intentions are misinterpreted. When we're cast by another into being a certain kind of person that we don't feel to be that kind of person. There are many ways that we can feel harmed or wronged. And if nobody ever stirred our anger, how could we cultivate patience with others? And this is a big part of this parami, of patience with others. Shantideva once said that the Buddhas turn the wheel of the Dharma in the midst of fierce flames. Do not become angry with those who harm you. But if you do, then however much anger you feel, cultivate that much patience too. We see why it is called transcendent patience, because we're not talking about ivory tower type of patience here. We're talking about the patience that perhaps we can have the intention to cultivate in the very, very midst of those moments when we feel most resistant, perhaps hurt, most misused in some way. It is called transcendent patience because in a way it's learning to step out of those very familiar, habitual, codependent grooves of you're angry with me, I will be angry with you. You hurt me, I will hurt you. You reject me, I will reject you. These are the codependent grooves of relationship breakdown, aren't they? And where does it actually begin to end? We could easily imagine, of course, this other person should improve. But perhaps maybe it's in our hands. But to step out of those codependent grooves of reactivity, I think is really for us often to enter into the more unknown territory of non-self and compassion. Because it's really that invitation to begin to examine. Yes, as human beings, we do have the capacity, of course, to be hurt, of course, to feel wronged, to feel the pain of rejection. But that capacity to then question, even in the midst of that, who is being rejected? What is being rejected? What kind of image inwardly is being rejected? I think the hardest place to cultivate patience is in the face of the injured self. But the sense of the injured self is really the ground of most of our anger and our ill will and our aversion. Someone offends us, insults us, disrespects us. We find ourselves again in those codependent grooves, tight, contracted. I will deliver the same. In this, Shantideva does come, he says, unruly beings are numberless. There is not enough time to overcome them all. Uprooting these thoughts of ill will is like defeating all of your enemies. And as a path, you know, and we talked about this yesterday too, you know, the small moments of impatience, the small moments of pushing away, the small moments of resistance are so important. And this Shantideva says, there is nothing whatsoever that is not made more possible through acquaintance and through intimacy. And through becoming acquainted with small harms, I shall patiently learn to embrace and understand greater harms. So the tolerance really cultivated in the small moments of irritation and annoyance actually builds our capacity to meet greater harms. Perhaps this is so evident to us, but it's so difficult to translate into us, I think, a lived level. I think this is the most challenging area of embodiment. But we actually know that to meet harm with harm is to increase the amount of suffering in this world. What is gained in meeting harm with harm? Often but a momentary sense of satisfaction. You know, that I stood my ground and I showed you. We fear sometimes that someone will get away with harming us, but why do we hold this exaggerated responsibility of making sure the entire world is accountable for every thought? You know, we are not the ones who are going to have to live with that mind. When in my earliest teacher, because I had a lot of difficulty with this, I had a lot of difficulty with patience, I had a lot of difficulty with forgiveness. I had a lot of difficulty in bringing compassion to those who bring harm. And so my teacher used to have this kind of statement that repeated, can't even count the number of times, of swallow the blame. Doesn't mean swallow the injustice. Doesn't mean swallow our capacity for wise action, but swallow the blame. Swallow the blame. He said it's they who are spitting in the wind. Patience when harmed. Does anybody have anything to say about this one? Patience when feeling harmed. Yes. Okay.
but it stops.
Absolutely.
The train from leaving the
station. Absolutely.
And I, you know, sometimes I wonder about. I kind of crave a toolbox of quick things to call up to like that, you know, because even if I don't believe it. Can slow things down and help for me. But I want to believe it. and I think my experience yesterday when we were talking about restraint was that I reflected on a very recent time when I wanted so badly to say the habitual response that, you know, and I felt like this, what had happened was bait, you know?
Yeah.
And I saw it as bait, and I did swallow it. And what came up yesterday was
swallow the bait or swallow the response?
Swallow the blame. The response was that what happened yesterday when I reflected on that is a huge wave of grief, just tremendous wave of grief. But I think I was able to hold that in compassion for us both. So. I don't know if I have a question, but it's just that I guess I really value those quick tools that can just cut through.
Could you all hear the question enough? I mean, I think we go back to talking about these heat of the moment things, which I really love that phrase, actually, because these are the moments when we're so prone to swallow the bait, you know. I receive feeling misharmed, I will harm you. You know, we're so prone to swallow the bait. And there is something about creating those interruptions, slowing down the momentum, you know, having the mindfulness, sometimes to know that territory so well, that we can slow down the process. And what you're saying, you know, you use, you know, that longing for a toolbox of how to just not go there. Not because it's wrong or suppressing or bad, but because you've been there enough to know the outcome. And to know that it's not going to end up in a different place. So I think the kind of toolbox of how to step out of the codependency of those reactions is actually so important, and it's rooted in insight. Not because I'm afraid to say this or because I think it's bad, but because I know the outcome for myself and others. You know? So we can, you're using those phrases, you know, this is not me, this does not belong to me, this is not who I am. You don't have to believe them. Remember how much we've talked about you don't have to feel something to do it? You don't have to believe them, but you are planting a certain seed in those moments, not using those phrases as a mantra or as a cliche, but almost as a real question. But in those moments, you are planting a seed. Now, when we come out of those moments, when we haven't engaged in the codependency of swapping insults, you know, or swapping harm, sometimes we do come out of those moments and we experience a tremendous painfulness of that quality of relating, which can be so marred by misunderstanding or by aversion or by judgment or blame. We feel the tremendous painfulness of that. And that's actually, you know, so it's not the end of the story when you use those phrases. It's actually giving you enough moment to actually be able to feel, oh, that is so painful. What does this ask for? It's not even about the painfulness of another, the situation. It is about actually just the painfulness of human disconnection and ill will. It's the painfulness of ill will. You know, whether we're receiving it or extending it, it is the painfulness of ill will. And to have that sense of, what does this need? Because there's often no solution. There's no way to fix often, you know, those difficult relationships. All that we're left with is the capacity to find the compassion for the painfulness of ill will. And, you know, because we see this on a very microcosmic level in our one-to-one relationships, but look at our world. The painfulness of ill will. You know, and what is born when this codependency of ill will is just not questioned or not stopped. In those little moments, it's lessening the mountain of suffering. They may not feel very important. They are important. You know, because there's a choice that you're making there in terms of what path you follow. What am I feeding in that moment? And so sometimes it means foregoing, you know, the delights of self-righteousness. which are very, very passing delights. Very transient delights, the delights of self-righteousness.
Mm-hmm. That will work just like it's not to argue with anybody, right? It's just swallowing or not have strong opinion.
Well, that's an interesting one, that, because we do have views, don't we? I mean, we do have views, and some of them are actually quite important. You know, some of them are deeply significant, you know. They may be, but there's a difference between knowing a view which we do have that is really deeply committed to bringing as much clarity and truthfulness and honesty to a situation. And when we are using a view to cement a sense of identity versus another identity. Because, you know, when we look at so much conflict in this world, how much it is this clash of views that are being equally clung to on both sides. But it doesn't mean to become a marshmallow in the world, you know, that we have nothing to say about injustice or oppression or whatever. Of course we have something to say about it. But there is something that when we enter into the world of views and challenging status quos and challenging conventions, we all know how incredibly careful we need to be with wise speech, with sometimes also understanding the deep anxiety and insecurity within people that leads us to cling to paltry views to make us someone and make us feel that we belong and have a sense of identity. We need to appreciate sometimes the very deep fears that are behind tightly clung to opinions. But that doesn't mean that we... And to feel some compassion to that and to know right moment. And it's where, you know, we have to think about right moments, right speech, wise action, right times. But it doesn't mean dissolving into a marshmallow, but it means stepping out of ill will and clinging. And that's such a big challenge for us. And so it means that, you know, some of those arguments I'm not going to have. You know? I'm not going to argue about whose view is right. I'm more concerned with what might be truthful in the moment to the best of my ability to see it. because difficulty is that most people in this world think their views are right. But this is why the paramis, you know, are so real, because it is often speaking to these places of very human relationships and dilemmas about how do we meet this world that feels so fractured, and how are we part of that fracturing, and how can we be part of healing that fracturing. And certainly not just about our internal reality. You know, paramis are very, very relational qualities. You know, they are relational qualities with life and with most often adversity. More about patience when wronged.
I was thinking a bit about what you said about this exaggerated sense of responsibility to hold others accountable, and I reflected a bit on the idea that I feel that exaggerated sense most when other people are wronged. That I care about, or I don't know, disadvantaged populations or children, things like that, and maybe people that don't have the ability to kind of hold other people accountable.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have any.
Well, it is a minefield, isn't it? Because, I mean, even if we look at what we call the justice system in this country, where we hold people accountable by putting them to death or imprisoning them forever. You know, but are they really being held accountable? Or is it satisfying our need to make someone pay? Does it make a difference in the world? And I'm not judging, don't want to judge that or blame that, you know, but we're struggling to find ways for people to take responsibility for themselves. You know, that is what societies do. They struggle to find ways to make people hold responsibility. And we live in worlds where often that is not so, where it's always somebody else's fault or somebody else's problem or somebody else is doing something wrong, from the microcosmic level to the macrocosmic level. Now, it certainly doesn't, you know, and this is where it's so important that many of these qualities have these shadow sides, you know, because for example, really understanding that in the end, that, you know, this is the biggest part that is hard for compassion, is to have compassion in the face of ignorance. It is easier to find compassion for those, you know, small children and you know, people who are clearly innocent victims of suffering. But the biggest compassion, and this is really part of this fabric, is what does compassion look like in the face of ignorance, in the face of those who perpetrate harm? And it you know, I mean, it's almost like the whole training of compassion in the Bodhisattva path is building up to that one. And that's the one where we're asked to swallow the blame, but that doesn't mean condoning. It doesn't mean closing our eyes. It doesn't mean pretending everything's all right and it's their karma, you know, and they're just going to have to deal with it, all the rest of it. So this is the minefield of this that we travel, you know, because compassion in the face of ignorance. If I look at myself, you know, times when I felt angry, impatient, wanted to harm someone, you know, through words, I look, you know, do I really want that? Where is the beginning of that want? I can trace it back through generations. I don't know the beginning. I don't even know the beginning. If I was, and you know, if I was born into those conditions where I have nothing and I'm hopeless and despairing, you know, a couple of weeks ago my son got really injured in a mugging, you know. Do I really want to spend my life pursuing that person? I would love for that person to understand the harmfulness of their actions. I don't even know who that person is. I don't even know why they did that. You know, I will probably never know why they did that. Can I feel compassion for that ignorance, for someone who is so lost and misguided that this is their life? You know, I can feel compassion for that. It doesn't mean that I don't think that somebody should actually maybe, that it would be a wonderful thing for this person to be guided into different directions in their lives. And if I could be part of that, which I'm not, I would be. But it's that fine line, isn't it, about when to see beneath the story of someone who perpetrates harm, to see that very human lostness that any of us could be prey to, and yet to know that there the action is not acceptable. To know the action's not acceptable. And how do we respond to that? So it's a little bit like when we talked about generosity yesterday. There's first the inner response, then the second piece about how do we translate that inner response into wise action. Two pieces here. And the inner response is so important, because if we cannot find the patience or the compassion, our action will probably not be wise action. It will probably be entering into that territory of codependent ill will. And that really increases the amount of suffering in the world. But it's why we see there's no kind of like standard here, is there? It's an ongoing investigation. And that is something very dynamic, but you know, if we don't undertake it, where do we stay in the landscape of what we know, the familiar, the reactivity, the impulse? It's not easy. Yeah.
You no doubt know that the political situation in this country is really challenging right
yes.
now. A lot of acrimony. And even listening to it on the radio can really bring up a lot of negative feelings.
Yeah.
I tend to just really limit how much I even listen to it to try to avoid that. But I wondered if you had any thoughts about looking at that.
Well, I do think there is a, because so much of it is repetitive, quite frankly, you know. I mean, it's almost like that song again, you know. I mean, so much of it is repetitive that I think in that situation it's actually wise to limit it. You know, because I personally never feel that it's good to somehow contract our world and not know, you know, out of fear, out of aversion, and not want to know what's happening in our societies, our communities, our countries, our world. I think we need to know, even if it's really painful. But I do think when we get into that realm of, you know, quite frankly, just repetitive ranting, you know, it's not much benefit in overexposure. It's not like something new is being said. I think that is good to limit. I mean, you think about sort of like in Buddhist teaching, how much the Buddha talks, you know, about guarding the sense doors. And I don't think guarding the sense doors is the same as defending the sense doors, you know. It's not about contracting, it's not about curling into some cocoon, you know, where the world mustn't enter. But I think there's a kind of quality of wise discernment here about when too much is too much. You know, and when we're actually starting to feed a certain amount of agitation or craving or aversion, there is something about guarding the sense doors. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with dependent origination, but in that wheel of life, the sense doors are often portrayed as, you know, the open windows and the door in an empty house, I might say, you know, and the world is coming in, and we need, the only place we can do is to look both at what is coming in, but also at what's going out through those same windows and doors. patience to bear hardships. And here I'm not going to bore you with all our, you know, some of all our incredible stories when I was practicing in Asia. Our war stories, you know, that all people of my generation have, you know, when I was practicing in Asia, you know. But because we don't have to be in Asia to have hardships. We don't have to be practicing in difficult environments to have hardships that we're asked to be patient with and the capacity to embrace. Because I think we see a lot in our lives how much we can be governed by this desire to fix. You know, desire to fix things, which is actually sometimes another way of saying hardship should not be part of our life. Hardships for the sake of the Dharma. It's actually not just the capacity to bear hardships, but the capacity to bear hardships for the sake of the Dharma means what is it that takes us away from staying close to what is true and liberating? Now this has many dimensions. You know, have you ever noticed how many reasons we can find not to practice? You know, oh, I don't feel well today. I have a cold. Can't possibly sit with a cold. You know, how can you practice when you've got a cold? excuse me. You know, I don't feel well. Not a good time to be mindful. I'm not insulting anybody. Not a good time to practice. I don't feel well. I'm sick. Not the right conditions. It's too noisy. You know, it's too noisy. You know, I'm traveling. It's too cold. You know, not even the right cushion. Here's the big one. I'm too busy. I'm too busy to practice. It's so easy to engage in postponement practice, thinking that we will practice later in ideal moments. It's interesting, again, in the Tibetan, there's a saying, by the time you have set yourself up with a comfortable place to stay, plenty of food, warm clothes, and a generous benefactor, you have completely cultivated the demon before even starting to cultivate the Dharma. I think that's quite a good one. And we could, you know, make this much bigger, you know. By the time you have set yourself up with a comfortable place to stay, plenty of food, warm clothes, and a generous benefactor, you have completely cultivated the demon before even starting to cultivate the Dharma. You know, and it's just talking about that sense of conditions have to be perfect in order for me to be awake, in order for me to be present, in order for me to investigate. We too easily think in terms of obstacles. You know, that like my life is an obstacle, you know, the situation I'm in is an obstacle, you know, my illness is an obstacle, the difficulties. We do have difficulties in life. When do we turn them into obstacles? Thinking we must have the perfect environment inwardly and outwardly in order to be present. Well, the history of practice, I think, is always that, you know, essentially we live in an imperfect environment. No matter how much gloss we want to put on that. We live in an imperfect environment. Patience, tolerance, you know, the ability to stay with what is. To practice within all environments. The patience, the tolerance to be truthful. the patience to sometimes say what is truthful without fearing disapproval. The last quality is the patience to face the truth without fear. It's like we don't want to hear about impermanence often, don't we? Especially if we're just falling in love or, you know, got a new car or, you know, something's just worked out. Can you imagine somebody, well, actually a friend of mine, to say this, never invite him to conduct your wedding ceremony. But actually turned up to conduct the wedding ceremony of a couple of our friends and started talking about impermanence. This was kind of like really a Buddhist wedding, you know. And in one way, you know, part of me thought, oh no, don't do this, you know. And part of me thought, well, maybe this is the times we need to remember. Because actually these are the times, isn't it, when things are really sort of going so well and wonderfully. These are the last times we want to hear about impermanence, isn't it? I mean, we want to hear about impermanence when we're in the midst of a root canal. But we don't want to hear about impermanence when, you know, when things are really going well. But actually impermanence runs through all of those conditions, doesn't it? And those are the times actually amidst not only the lovely but also the pleasant when actually we're most prone to forgetfulness. So the patience to face the truth without fear about change, about the emptiness of self, about unsatisfactoriness. There are stories of monks blocking their ears when hearing the teaching of non-self. But we need to remember the practice is intended to disturb us. Too often without being disturbed, we're also not awakened. We might need to let go. We might need to question. There are so many implications of the kind of core truths of life, you know, of change, of emptiness, of instability, of non-self. There's so many implications because if we think, translate those simple teachings from being some kind of an ideology about what does this mean for our lives? How are we asked to respond to that reality? We might be asked to change the shape of our minds and often the shape of our lives. And that can be terrifying for people. Terrifying to think that groundlessness has actually always been the reality that we've tried to put so many layers on top of that we don't see it. You know, it might change the shape of our minds and our lives to really understand impermanence and to know, you know, clinging and holding may be the recipe for suffering. May well be the recipe for suffering. Can be terrifying to know that we live on shifting sands and we will face loss. Understanding non-self, as you mentioned earlier, when we live in a culture where so much is based upon being somebody, defined by what we have or own, or basically defined by what we've been successful in clinging to. So far. We forget the so far bit. You know, what does it mean to live our life on the basis of non-self, on non-becoming, on non-clinging? It's huge implications that are almost too vast to even begin to embrace. But the place where we begin to embrace them, I think, is moment to moment. Where do we live out of alignment with these simple truths?